This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The Illinois Department of Public Health is doing something that is foreign to a lot of people, urging them to waste water in some cases. For instance, Justin DeWitt of the Illinois Department of Public Health says slightly elevated lead levels in school water qualify for that.
There could be a lot of reasons they're seeing those very low levels, and what we often find is if the district and its students just flush a little bit of water through that fixture before they use it, that those levels typically will go down to zero or what we call non-detect.
GLT's Ryan Dunham has more on the risks and fears of lead in school water, plus some evangelicals are experiencing voters' remorse about the Trump presidency. GLT's Judy Valente talks with area pastors about the duty to speak out and how to do it in a non.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal parents received troubling news to start the school year. Slightly elevated lead levels found in some Unit 5 and District 87 elementary schools. The lead was found because of a new state law that went into effect this year, requiring elementary schools and daycares statewide to test their drinking water. GLT's Ryan Denham tries to answer the real question, how worried should parents be about this? He starts by asking Justin DeWitt, the Illinois Department of Public Health's Environmental Health Chief Engineer.
I think what level should you be concerned about? Really, any level of lead, you should be concerned. But within that, I think there's levels of concern. Should you pull your kid out of that school or take some drastic steps? Absolutely not. You know, that is not the message we're sending. I think parents need to ask questions and work affirmatively with the districts that they belong to about what their plans are to address any levels of lead in the drinking water at the school.
District 87 notified parents last month that elevated lead levels were found in possible drinking water sources at four of its elementary schools, Bent, Irving, Oakland, and Sheridan. Most are kitchen-type sinks in cafeterias, and others are sinks in nursing offices. One is a classroom sink that's also used as a drinking fountain. Here is District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley talking to me last month.
I'm not a health expert, but obviously if I'm a parent of a kid, I may have some questions. We provide them with some information to help answer those questions.
District 87 has shut off each of the water sources and will address them by replacing fixtures, adding filters, and other changes. Parents were notified because fixtures in those four schools tested just above the state's new lead threshold for notification, 5 parts per billion in the water. In Unit 5, 6 schools were found with lead levels above that notification threshold. It's Fairview, Colleen Hoos, Hudson, Parkside, Sugar Creek, and Towanda. Unit 5 superintendent says those lead levels of above 5 parts per billion were found in what is called a first flush of water when a tap is first opened. Those levels dropped to non-detectable once the water in the faucets had run for several minutes, what's called a flush. Daniel says Unit 5 intends to fix the problem by replacing the aerators and faucets that contain lead.
We'll probably look at non-detectable numbers, but if there were, we would go to another phase of mitigation, which could be a filter. It could be a replacement of a sink, something of that nature, and we'll just work our way through.
Here's Justin DeWitt from the Illinois Department of Public Health talking about how schools are dealing with problem fixtures once they're found.
Where we see these excessive levels, meaning, you know, triple digits or even high double digits, we anticipate, and I think most schools are taking immediate action. They're taking that kitchen sink or that faucet out of service, and they're trying to find whatever way possible to reduce the amount of lead in that water. Usually it involves changing out the fixture, and we see an improvement right away. And I've not found a school yet that isn't acting on those levels when they get them. Where we see these single-digit levels, there could be a lot of reasons for that, and those are hard to track down. It could be somewhere in the plumbing, not in the fixture. There could be a lot of reasons they're seeing those very low levels, and what we often find is if the district and its students just flush a little bit of water through that fixture before they use it, that those levels typically will go down to zero or what we call non-detect. So some of it is just a cultural shift for us as users of potable water in buildings, rather than walking up to the drinking fountain and, you know, bending over to get a drink and drinking that first drop of water. We may let that run for 30 seconds or so before we do that. And just by doing those few simple things, students, teachers, parents can all reduce their risk. And that really applies not just in schools, but everywhere we go.
Illinois environmental groups work with the Public Health Department and Illinois Attorney General's Office to craft the new state law, which went into effect in January. Jennifer Walling is Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council, which was involved with shaping the law.
Well, I think that for us, lead in drinking water and lead in the environment has been a huge concern for decades. But I think with the crisis that happened in Flint, there is an increased public awareness of the ability of lead pipes to contribute lead into the drinking water that we have. So I think that we've been concerned with this issue for a number of years, but this was an opportunity. There was the public will to really do something about it. In Illinois, there's been a very checkered history of lead contamination and lead impacting our children. The state has done a lot on paint, but we have a huge number of lead pipes. And this doesn't refer to schools, but just to give you an idea, Illinois really kept installing lead pipes in many places up until the last moment that they could. Lead service lines stopped being in use in 1987. I have heard data from the Environmental Defense Fund that suggests that a quarter of all lead service lines in the nation are located in Illinois. So we have a huge amount of lead that we're going to have to eventually replace that is within our water system, our water infrastructure. And there have been hot spots of different tests that have shown that in certain schools, there are issues with fountains.
There's a reason that elementary schools and daycares, with the youngest children in Illinois, were chosen. Here's Justin DeWitt.
The target audience for lead and lead poisoning is really the infants through 6 years of age. And so as you look at, for instance, adults, our absorption of lead is much different than an infant's. And so as the child becomes younger, we become more and more concerned about exactly what levels of lead that kid might be receiving. But some of the factors that we know about are just diminished IQ, diminished brain development, and in the higher doses of lead, we start to see physiological issues with their body growth, their ability to control their muscles, and things of that nature. So it's really a broad spread of from everything from diminished IQ all the way up to very obvious physiological defects that come from being lead poisoned.
District 87 told parents that the state's new threshold for notifying them about lead, 5 parts per billion, is lower than the federal government's safe water drinking threshold of 15 parts per billion. Justin DeWitt says the real target needs to be zero.
A little bit of apples and oranges. When you look at the federal drinking water standards, it provides for 15 part per billion action level. And what that means is when the water supplier finds in their standard sampling values higher than 15 parts per billion, that they have to take action, either providing corrosion control or taking some other action to try and get those numbers down. It's really not a health-based standard. It's more of a treatment, a corrosion control treatment action level for those providers. So when we looked at the law and we looked at where we might try to establish some values that were meaningful in a public health sense, that the only value that really means much of anything is zero. So when you look at any amount of lead being dangerous, the only place we can truly feel safe is when there's none there at all. And so non-detect is something that we use a lot in the public health realm to talk about when things are truly safe.
Jennifer Walling from the Illinois Environmental Council says even low-level lead exposure needs to be flagged.
These parents should really encourage the schools to do what they can to replace any of those areas, to implement proper flushing protocol, to replace fountains that may have an issue, just to make sure that they're safe. And One of the things with very low-level lead exposure is that there's not outright symptoms like there might be with high levels of lead exposure. And so, but it still can cause organ damage, brain damage. I mean, I don't want parents to totally rush and look for cures for any of this. I mean, only high levels of lead is there a therapy that you go through. The other low levels of lead kind of leave your body over time. It's not a enormous freak out, but we should work to reduce and get rid of as much lead as possible in schools and that children are exposed to.
State health officials and school districts have been working on this testing since the beginning of the year. Justin DeWitt says the public health department got lots of questions from schools and their consultants up front. The department spent a lot of time interpreting the law and producing guidelines for those districts.
Once that information got out and schools started to digest it and understand that perhaps like sampling the water itself was something that they could do internally, I think things settled down a little bit and they just got to sampling. And once they had the results, getting those submitted to us and communicating those results to parents. So I think the initial angst that we saw early in the year has perhaps waned somewhat, and now we're just in this mode of trying to make sure that all the schools who are required to test do so by the end of the calendar year.
Jennifer Walling says the perfect time for testing is now, when the kids are back in the schools.
So we have seen some of the data from schools that were, for example, requesting waivers that have done this before. We've seen different school districts that are doing this, and you are there are a lot of school districts that are doing this now. It's hard to do over the summer when students aren't in because there is a standard for when you're testing lead that it has to be sitting there for only a certain period of time. So it can't be sitting there for 3 days. It has to be, I think it's 8 to 18 hours. So it's really perfect to do during the school year, at 6 a.m. before the kids get there. So that's when kind of why a lot of the testing is being done now. This is really the perfect time to do it. We're seeing a lot of school districts do it. I have heard of some places that really are seeing elevated levels of lead. The vast majority of samples are coming in at zero or undetectable. So that's great, but at least we're identifying where the issues are.
That's Jennifer Walling from the Illinois Environmental Council. Before that was Justin DeWitt from the Illinois Department of Public Health. I'm Ryan Denham.
Daycares before the year 2000 will also be required to conduct testing once rules are developed by the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services and the Illinois Department of Public Health.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Credit Union, offering the member business advantage with a team of dedicated member business advisors and specialized products and services designed to help small businesses thrive. Details at MidIlliniCU.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new approach to arts in the town of Normal. A majority of evangelical Christians have thrown their support to President Trump in the 2016 election, as did a large number of conservative Catholics and mainline Protestants who agreed with candidate Trump's positions on abortion and the economy. Nearly a year into the Trump presidency, persistent questions about the president's ethics, his truthfulness, and behavior are raising concern among voters. Are pastors speaking out about this? How much is appropriate to say from the pulpit? Elise Nelson Winger is a Lutheran minister and chaplain at Illinois Wesleyan University. Scott Burkle is a pastor of White Oak Bible Church in Carlock. Burkle starts off the conversation telling GLT's Judy Valente that some conservative Christians are experiencing voter remorse.
I think that most conservative Christians held their nose and voted for Trump. I can't speak for all conservative Christians. I can't speak as a defender of the administration because I'm not. I am a conservative, politically evangelical Christian. But here's what I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid of is that my worldview being represented by such a rotten example has the effect of making that worldview diminished in people's eyes.
Have you ever specifically addressed that from the pulpit?
There are times where I do address it. I talked about Nebuchadnezzar's hubris and how he thought, is this not great Babylon that I've built by my mighty hand, and so on. And one of the things that I gave as an illustration was a tweet from Donald Trump where he said, "Sorry, losers and haters, but my IQ is one of the highest, and you all know it. Please don't feel stupid or insecure. It's not your fault." And so I just made the connection that kind of hubris that exists among world leaders, it lives on today. And we need to remember that God's the one that rules, not human beings.
Reverend Nelson Winger, you're a member of a women's clergy group. You're in contact with clergy members as chaplain of Illinois Wesleyan. How do you talk about politics or the president without offending members of your congregation who may have voted for that person?
One of the things I love about being a part of the church as a member and a pastor is that I get to work with and be in community with people who I sometimes deeply disagree with on a political level. But we find places of common purpose and common ground.
How do you see your fellow clergy members addressing some of the daily grind of issues that are coming out? Sometimes rude, crude statements, sometimes just untrue statements.
Right. And this is where there's a difference. And I think we are in a period of time that calls for, and I don't say this lightly, where we need to rebuke the ways of some leaders who are willfully distorting and misrepresenting the truth. You cannot have a conversation with civility, even when you deeply disagree, when you are not dealing with people who are being honest.
I want to give Pastor Berkel a chance to jump in on that very point. We're taught in church to tell the truth.
Yeah, so the challenge there is that cuts across both sides of the political spectrum. There isn't one group that has a corner on hubris or exaggeration. That's true. I loved what Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York said once. He said, everybody's entitled to their own opinions, but no one's entitled to their own facts.
Now that Charlottesville has happened and there's this whole national discussion about condemnation of white supremacist groups, what should pastors be saying about all of this?
That it is time for us to speak, to stand up, and to find ways, new ways, to really address the sin of racism and to speak very clearly that white supremacy and neo-Nazism and membership in the KKK is absolutely on every level antithetical to our understandings of humanity and of God.
Pastor Berkel, I'd like to give you an opportunity to weigh in. Did you talk with your congregation about Charlottesville?
I did speak about this. I think it identifies a key thing. There is such a thing as absolute right and absolute wrong. And this was not a moment to try to talk about, well, there's both sides to an issue. This was a moment to say, there's really one thing that you got to say no to, and that's racism and anti-Semitism. We've been down that road many times in human history, and I think this was another moment to remind people of the importance of that.
Did anybody in your congregation react to that?
I don't think so, no.
How much have you seen your colleagues, and I throw it out to both of you, Pastor Berkel, jump in, how much of your colleagues talked about immigration, for example, or this, we just went through this huge debate about repealing the Affordable Care Act. How much did you preach about it?
I didn't preach about that at all. I think that...
Should you have?
I take a positive view of rights rather than a negative view of rights. So what I would say is that rights are things that God has given and that government is there to protect, rather than rights are things that government must provide. So while health care is a necessity, I don't see it as a right. So, for example, one of the ways that our church does is we support, we have a really interesting ministry in West Bloomington where we support the Emmanuel Healthcare Center, and we have a really great partnership with them. Our desire is to deal with grassroots on a personal level rather than to say, well, government is going to solve our problems. I frankly don't see that.
The Bible does not provide 20th century policy prescriptions. It gives us the questions and the values to be able to point toward those. And I think the preachers I know want to be about engaging that. And my church has always believed that we are called again into society and to be a partner with government. And that government is no less broken than any other institution, but it's also the people, and we are the people.
Would both of you say that this is a very critical time for the church and the kind of role the church can play in America?
I absolutely think it's a critical time. I think it's an opportunity to come together ecumenically, to speak about core values and commitments, to find ways that are in deep contrast to much of the political dialogue.
Pastor Burkle, your take on whether this is an important time for churches.
It's always an important time for the church. I think this is an important time where the gospel gets out. I'm not quite as maybe critical of the president and his administration as some would be. I am critical of him. I've lived long enough to see the political pendulum swing back and forth several times, and I really want to be a person who stays true to the text of Scripture and prophetically speaks into the culture, but with the hope of the good news of the gospel.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on then. Reverend Elise Nelson Winger is the chaplain of Illinois Wesleyan University and also a leader in the local Illinois Lutheran Church. Pastor Scott Burkle is from the East White Oak Bible Church in Carlock. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
A recent Pew Research Center poll found that 78% of white evangelicals support the job President Trump is doing, compared to 39% of the general electorate. One evangelical pastor told an interviewer that throughout the Bible and throughout history, God uses rulers who are not themselves godly.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Allison Bailey. Like you, I'm part of many organizations. My GLT contribution also makes me part of a community who believes in substance over sound bites. I can always count on NPR programming to cover top national global stories with depth and accuracy. But the news these days can be overwhelming, so I'm grateful for WGLT's music and smart entertainment programming. This fund drive is underway. Join the GLT community and renew your financial commitment, or make a first-time contribution. Click on Donate at WGLT.org.
Every year, we take a little time to remind you how important your financial support is to NPR and GLT. We explain that this public radio station depends on voluntary contributions from listeners like you. And because we trust you'll get the message and contribute, we're limiting these reminders to short breaks like this one. Show us we're right. Contribute now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. The town of Normal hosts a variety of cultural events through the year, from the Sugar Creek Arts Festival in high summer to Santa's Station in the dark of winter. And now the town has a new manager to help mold the cultural spirit of Uptown. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
As the town of Normal finishes filling up the big hole with a big building, it's also filling a need in its Uptown staff. Adam Fox has been with the town since 2015, managing, among a number of things, the Normal Theater. Fox is now the newly minted Civic Arts Manager for the town of Normal, and he says this is an evolution of the job he already had.
Which was Theater and Civic Arts Manager, so in many ways the title has just contracted, but the duties expanded. The Civic Arts Manager for the town, what I'll be doing is still programming the Normal Theater and thinking about everything that's happening on screen and on stage over there, but with a larger eye on how that impacts the arts in the community in general. Specifically, I'll be doing a lot of the Uptown events with Joe Tully stepping away from the position of Uptown manager. I'll be the one that is overseeing a lot of the festivals that we have every year, Sugar Creek Arts Festival, Sweet Corn and Blues Festival, Make Music Normal, which had already been in my bailiwick, and all of those different events in Uptown that make that such a great destination to come to if you're a resident here in town. The Cultural Arts Department has been recently formed within the last year or so. Shelley Burlingmeyer is the director of that department, so I am reporting to her and within that department have been there for the last little bit here. And as a department, we're kind of defining what that vision is as we move forward of how we want to create the best opportunities for the community to engage in the arts on all levels and in all disciplines and in all possibilities.
Well, Adam, is there something that you're just itching to put out there, to put your own stamp on Uptown and the cultural arts programming?
Well, I think we have such a great opportunity with Uptown Normal to create a public art space. I think that the idea of...
You mean like a permanent space or just the whole Uptown itself is available as a space?
I think both in some ways, actually. I mean, now that you bring that up, I think the former is very interesting to think about how to continue to expand some of the offerings we have, like the murals and some of the art that we already have out there. But the latter is more what I was thinking, the idea of using that as a footprint to be able to really celebrate the arts in very much the same way that we already do. Make Music Normal is an example to talk about, because that really is a participatory music festival. The whole idea is that community musicians of all levels, from our, you know, 6-year-old piano player that we had open the day all the way up through poster children who have been, you know, touring and performing for 30 years on a national level, to be able to showcase the musicians that we have and the musical talent we have in this community across all stages and across and just welcoming people in. So thinking about that for other types of art, could we have a theater festival that's akin to that? Do something like a fringe festival? Could we have something with the visual arts that's an expansion out of the university galleries uptown and continues to transform things that way, perhaps playing off Sugar Creek? I mean, this is all riffing. I'm literally making this up as I go. But that's exciting opportunities, right? It's such a great thing to think about, this wonderful public space and this great gathering space we have off of the roundabout and expanding in all directions, to think about using that. So yeah, it's real exciting.
Well, let's focus in on the Normal Theater. And you've been there for a number of years now, and you've been making some tweaks and that sort of thing, including adding something called Vaudeville Mondays. Now, what are you trying to achieve with bringing vaudeville back?
So we thought it was a fun way of categorizing this idea of what we've been doing on Monday nights. We had had alternating Mondays where we had comedy and music, and we were trying to do that same thing I was just talking about, where we were showcasing local talent and either giving comics some mic time, giving musicians the opportunity to perform in a venue such as the theater, and give audiences the chance to expand on, or experience that for free. And what we were finding was we were sort of drawing splintered audiences. They were either there for one show or the other show, and we really wanted the folks coming out for the comedy shows to see these really great musicians we would have on alternating Mondays. And we wanted the folks that were coming out to those music shows to have the chance to experience comedy in there. And we said, well, how do we make something that does all of that? How do we make this kind of variety show that is everything? It's comedy, it's music, it's dance, it's theater, it's magic, it's physical performance. And then we realized that already happened. There's, you know, a century's worth of template already existing there. So as we think about it, and as you look at shows like America's Got Talent and all those things where you say, I don't know what's going to come next, it's not going to be the same thing as what I saw before, but it's probably going to be entertaining and I'm going to be glad I saw it. That was what we wanted to try to achieve back in the theater. So it's free to attend. It's all ages appropriate. We want it to be for family audiences and be a great showcase and a great platform for community artists and arts organizations.
I think it's amazing you're bringing vaudeville back. I mean, originally, when vaudeville was king, and between the sets, so to speak, of vaudeville, they would show movies, they would show shorts, and it was almost a way of saying, okay, folks, time to move out. We need to get the audience, other audience in here. You've seen all the acts, and they would show the movies as a way of sort of driving people out. Mm-hmm. But then movies took off and got more and more popular, and so they would just focus in on the movies, and then they used vaudeville acts, like in between reels and things like that. And then vaudeville just went away. And lo and behold, what do we have here but a movie theater bringing vaudeville back?
Yeah,
that's
and
pretty
what's
cool.
What's interesting about the Normal Theater, too, is that it's been celebrated for so long that the theater was built in 1937 specifically for the talkies. It was specifically built for pictures with sound, which at the time was a little innovative to think about an auditorium really focusing on the acoustics for film. And it's not a converted vaudeville house, as so many classic theaters are. And for a long time, that was something that was kind of a something to hang our hat on and say, that's really an exciting thing for us. And now, of course, we're trying to create a vaudeville vaudeville show in a theater that isn't a converted vaudeville space. And we're going, curses! How if only we were one of those converted theaters, wouldn't that be amazing? So, but I think it's true to the aesthetic and the style and the feel when you go into that 1937 venue. You feel like you should be seeing a vaudeville act up on that stage. It just makes sense in there. So it's been very fun for us, and we're only just getting rolling with it.
For many years, the Normal Theater has had a relationship with Beyond Normal Films. Now, is that going to be continuing, or maybe with this change, will that be changing too?
Well, Beyond Normal Films has always been an outside organization. They've been independent of the Normal Theater and independent of the town of Normal. They have their own board structure, their own membership structure, their own dues that people paid into. And they have decided independently to cease operations as of the end of this calendar year. Beyond Normal Films, for the last two decades, has been an advisory group to the theater. They have suggested titles to be programmed that are independent films, foreign films, art house titles, documentaries. And I think a lot of the appreciation you see in this community does stem back from that group really strongly saying there's an audience for that here. You should show those films. Don't treat the Normal Theater just as a classic film venue. Use it as an art house cinema, when that title was really something that a lot of people weren't familiar with. So there's been a very strong and important lasting impact from Beyond Normal Films for that. But they've decided, just because of their own internal situation, to cease operations for that. We will still absolutely welcome and encourage people to suggest titles to us. It's the greatest dialogue we can have with people, to say, what do you want to see? What are the stories you're excited about? What's that film that you love from when you were a kid that we may not have seen because it's impossible to see everything, that we can now share with a larger audience? So Beyond Normal Films is stepping away. Our Farley Film Festival for fall of 2017 will be the last festival that they will be producing in their traditional model. But who's to say what the future holds and whether they'll reemerge at some point in a different model?
Adam Fox, the new Civic Arts Manager for the town of Normal, says the Normal Theater remains committed to showing indie films. He spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Portillo's has opened. There was a lot of buzz about that around town. The hot dog place is still in the first flush of interest in this restaurant-intense area. But there are indicators the impact is not exactly what some might have expected. Larry Carius writes about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene on Facebook. You might expect a new hot dog place to erode sales at existing establishments with similar fare. But Carius says that doesn't appear to be what's happening.
There's one I can talk about for sure, Charlie, and that's Windy City Wieners in Uptown Normal and downtown Bloomington. I've known the owners, Adam and Steve, since they opened, I think, maybe 8 years ago. So I gave Adam a text. I said, what kind of effect is Portillo's having on you? After Portillo's opened, their business has increased. They had the largest August that they've had since they've been open. They think September is going to be the largest September that they've had since they've opened.
Why?
The real answer is they don't know. I think maybe my son may have had the best idea, that with all the PR Portillo's has gotten, people are thinking about hot dogs or thinking about Italian beefs. They don't want to go out there and stand in line for an hour, and Windy City Wieners really sounds good. Adam told me they were genuinely concerned when Portillo's were coming in, because they were thinking about what happens to mama's pop stores when a Walmart comes in. So they went from being concerned to where their business so far, I think Portillo's been open for 6 weeks, that their business is up 10% over last year, and not only are they surprised, they are very, very pleased.
What's happening with Hardee's?
The Hardee's on East Oakland Avenue recently closed, and that leaves one in Bloomington Normal. Do you know where that's located, Charlie, the one we have left?
Is it on College Avenue?
It is on College Avenue. When I was doing my research on the story, and then I came up that we had six Hardee's at one time, but after I put it on the blog, we came up with a seventh one. And now I'm not sure that all seven were open at the same time. We have an example of a chain restaurant here that at one time they had 7 locations in Bloomington Normal, and they're down to 1.
That's a big shift, but not unlike the national shift regarding Hardee's. It's a chain that's not on the rise anymore.
No, you're right, and we've had other chains that have done the similar thing. Burger Chef, if you recall, they're no longer around. Big Boy's no longer around Bloomington Normal. So there have been other chains that this has happened to.
There is a chain that's moving in, Giordano's. Are they close to opening doors?
As we are talking right now, the corporate trainers are on site. They will be having their families and friends realistic training. The franchisee would not give me the exact date, but I think it would be a pretty good guess that it would be the week of October 8th.
There's been a change, too, I hear, in the fortunes of another pizza outlet that is a longtime community establishment.
Luca Grill, I think, as most of us probably know now, it's the Bloomington Normal restaurant that has been in the same location with the same name for the longest period of time. There are 2 longtime co-managers have purchased the restaurant. This is very good for the restaurant. John Koch, I believe, there has been there 21 years. Tony Smith, something like 18 years. They've actually been running it the last few years. And for the people who are the Luca Grill fans, they're not going to see any changes.
Another West Side community landmark is, there's a development there too, isn't there?
The restaurant that was the oldest in the same location in town, Parkview Inn, burned about a year ago. And the owner, Rick, he has always said he was going to rebuild. It's been a slow process for him, but I was talking to Rick last week. He has submitted the architectural plans to the city of Bloomington. All he's waiting for is the building permit before the construction starts.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Larry Karius about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. Larry writes about that on Facebook. Tell us about Namaste Plaza.
Namaste Plaza, they've had their grocery store on El Dorado Road for several years. And what they're going to be doing is moving to the former Hancock Fabric location. It's just really down the road to the south from them, several blocks. I'm excited about this, Charlie. They're obviously going to a larger location. The owner, KP, told me that this Namaste Plaza grocery store is going to be the second largest Indian grocery store in the Midwest. Not just state of Illinois, in the Midwest. He's got $3 million lined up in this. He's going to have a small restaurant in it. Well, actually not that small. It's going to seat about 40. The name of it I have a problem with. It's like Swagruha, and it's a popular South Indian name. It means welcome to my house. But what's exciting about the food that they're going to be serving is what they call the Indian street food, or chaat. And we've had some of the other Indian restaurants that will offer some of the chaat items, but this is the only Indian restaurant we have that's really going to be featuring Indian street food.
From Indian food to baked goods, what's happening?
Market Street Bakery closed, and this is an interesting story there. The owner, Patricia Ellison, she's been there for 28 years, and when I interviewed her for the story, Pat said, be sure and tell people how old I am. So Pat is 79, she's going to be 80, and she's kind of grudgingly closing the bakery.
Well, I mean, clearly she has another 20 years left to give. Wow, that's a huge run for her.
Well, and what's interesting about this is the baking is a one-person operation. For 28 years, maybe she's had just a little help every now and then. For the last, I don't know how many years, she goes in precisely at 11:45 at night. She bakes all night at 5 a.m., her case is full. And she told me, she said, what am I going to do if I can't come in and bake at 11:45 at night?
How about organic food offerings?
We have a new restaurant coming in that I personally had never heard of. It's Core Life Eatery. I guess you would call it kind of a health food restaurant and organic restaurant. What this is going to be different than some of the other smaller ones that we've had in the past. This is going to be a large, and I'm going to use the term health food restaurant. I'm not quite sure what the restaurant is. It's going to seat about 150 people. It's a small chain out of New York. I think, there was one just opened in Peoria, from what I understand, doing very well. This will be the second one in the state of Illinois. There is a third one planned for Champaign.
Core Life Eatery will be in half of the former Wildberries location in the Shops at College Hills. Larry Karius also says a number of downtown Bloomington establishments are celebrating longevity with significant anniversaries. The Bistro, 24 years, Fat Jack's, 20 years, and McGuire's, 20 years. He also says the old Ming's Buffet restaurant on Hershey has been Chinese, then Indian, now it will be Mexican. The name is Hacienda León. Larry Karius writes about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene on Facebook. He has more than 17,500 followers. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. To most Americans, the fiduciary rule on financial planning might not mean a whole lot. But for financial planners, stockbrokers, and investment advisors, it's a really big deal. It raises the standard for those people to serve their clients from giving advice that is suitable for their clients to giving advice that is in the client's best interest. In practice, this might greatly increase the level of work for financial advisors in getting to know their clients. Ed Jurtson is an ISU alum and past president and chairperson of the National Board of Directors of the Financial Planning Association. He spoke at ISU last week and says the financial planning industry is in flux.
The challenging part about the fiduciary rule, it's hard to argue that you shouldn't have the best interest of your client at heart. And so there are some in the industry that'll say, well, we already have a relatively high standard, which for people who are on a commission is the suitability standard. And so there are those in the profession that think it should be a higher standard being fiduciary. And so in our leadership, my leadership role with the Financial Planning Association, we thought that the fiduciary standard is the higher standard. So if you're going to be taking someone's full net worth and give them advice, why wouldn't you have the client's best interest at heart?
Are there unintended consequences to this rule, which many firms are implementing in spite of the slowdown that the administration has put on it?
Yeah, when the Department of Labor came out with a rule, we sent them a 39-page comment letter that said, this is great, but.
Only 39?
Only 39. I think we had one of the less lengthy rebuttals. But within that letter was some of the things that we saw, which were some of the unanticipated consequences of the original rule from that standpoint. One of the biggest things that get people nervous is the potential for litigation. It allows for class action lawsuits where a lot of the industry, the financial services industry, is protected by arbitration. So that gets some folks nervous that anyone can sue potentially, according to folks, for certain things, which talking to a lot of the individuals that are in the know when it comes to legal, the class action status is a pretty hard level to attain, but still it's the litigation risk that firms are looking at.
So that may be a spin-off consequence down the road once there's some experience with how it works in the marketplace. Are there consequences to the kinds of investors that management firms will be seeking out?
So if I look at what some of the firms have been talking about, there's a balance between the rhetoric of what's going to happen with the implementation of the rule and reality. In reality, would the conflict of interest rule change business practices as they are today? And the answer is yes, but in different ways for different groups. And so if I look at the average individual investor, what kind of advice, what kind of services are they getting now under a suitability standard? Are they getting full financial planning? Are they getting full advice? Or are they getting someone they can call into who are just managing their investments? And I think a lot of what we see is firms saying, you know what, a lot of these smaller investors are going to be put to the wayside because the suitability standard works now, but if we go to the fiduciary standard, it will cost us too much in terms of having that small revenue for the individual client.
And small revenue for the management firm, too. If they're not high net worth, are they going to be worth the labor that it takes to really do full due diligence and to give them the best possible advice?
That's the conundrum. So what kind of advice are they getting now in a suitability standard? So if the individuals are getting lower advice, is that bad advice or is that the best advice? So for instance, if someone is coming to me and they're like, well, should I pay off my credit card debt or should I invest? Well, if I only get paid by commission, right, I might not have that best interest in terms of paying off that credit card debt. So that is at the core of the challenge is what advice are they getting now? So if an individual is paying a small amount of revenue, right, on a commission side, which is suitability, can the firm rearrange that, get the same amount of revenue, and then also meet the needs of that individual client?
A somewhat higher level question, though, is it worth doing a full workup on somebody, their goals, their needs, the level of risk that they wish to accept, their financial plans, the diversity of their existing investments, and whether that meets all of those goals, if they're only worth a couple $100,000. That's a lot of work for a management firm to go through for somebody who may not be saving at a high rate or may not be investing at a high rate.
If you look at where the people who are most vulnerable, it's that person who has $100,000 or $200,000 who, if given bad advice, may take them decades to be able to recoup from that bad advice. And when we talk about the financial services profession, it gets a very bad rap. I mean, there's a lot of very good people out there doing very, very good work. It's that group that's out there that is just selling products that may not be in the best interest, which, again, with somebody with a lower net worth, it would take them a lot of years to recover, where if you've got somebody who's got a large account and large assets, you know, one small bad miss, that's just kind of a blip on their balance sheet, where, again, looking at that individual, that's where the most care should be needed, even though, again, potentially from a revenue standpoint, it might be a little bit more challenging.
So what's going to happen to those people who the big firms don't want to serve?
If you look at the trend when the fiduciary rule was first implemented, so what happened? A lot of firms automatically lowered their fees in regards to the advisory accounts. Different firms were already, this has already been in process for quite some time, even before the Department of Labor came about this rule. You've got major firms who are already telling their advisors, you know what, if this person doesn't have this amount of minimum, they're going to go over to this area, which already had a lower standard of care in regards to in lower one-on-one service. So this isn't anything new that the profession has been working on, because the cost of human interaction is very high and firms want to make sure that they're maximizing that revenue. But again, if we're looking at individual investor, those are the folks that really need the most amount of care and due diligence.
What will happen to them? Are they going to be shuffled off to 800 numbers? And if so, how will they get that care?
Excellent point. And again, that's already been happening. If I look at what's going on in the financial services profession, you look at some of these large advisory firms, the custodians that have been out there, the vanguards of the world, they're already having 1-800 call centers with certified financial planners to meet the needs of individuals. So that is the where the crux of the matter is what kind of advice can these individuals be given in a cost-effective way? There are a lot of folks out there, certified financial planners like myself, whose book of business is varied, where we're meeting the needs of people who have relatively small means and also meeting the needs of higher-end individuals.
Is there a yen legislatively or among professional associations to say there ought to be a place for these folks to get the kind of service that they're not getting, though?
Well, one of the things I look at is, for instance, when TurboTax came out, right? You've got something out there that didn't eviscerate the accounting industry. It helped people get a need or meet their needs from a very, you know, simple, straightforward level at a very cost-effective rate. I'm pretty confident, I believe in the capitalistic system, that if a lot of firms are, let's say, casting off these individuals, somebody is going to create a business model that's going to meet the needs of those individuals.
What might that look like?
So if I talk to several of the individuals in our profession, those involved in the Financial Planning Association, they do very well in what I'll call middle market clients, clients who have $50,000 to $100,000, and they do full comprehensive financial planning. They've made the model work. So what that may mean is not a lot of overhead. You don't have fancy addresses on streets, but you're in the towns where these folks can come and meet and also serve them in a fiduciary capacity. So again, as a believer in capitalism, somebody's going to find a business model that's going to be able to meet the needs of those individuals where they need to meet them, and it, not necessarily an 800 call-in number.
How does the time-intensive part of fiduciary responsibility affect the likelihood that someone is going a planner is going to rely on algorithm-based investment advice rather than individual?
So you have to remember that the Department of Labor rule is only concentrated on the retirement side of things. So if you happen to be rolling over a 401k plan into an IRA, you should know what value add that you're going to be able to bring to the table for that. It's not an extensive beyond what people are already doing, because the regulators on the commission side, which is FINRA, have already had this extensive knowledge of know your client. So by going over the divide and saying, well, you should know what the fees are for that 401k before rolling it over to you, isn't this a great expansive divide in terms of having to know your client more? That's normal in the system right now in regards to knowing your client. By expanding that knowledge a little bit more, if all you want to do is sales and sell a product, don't wrap that up in being a financial planner or calling yourself a financial advisor. Relish in the fact that you are a stockbroker, that you are selling product and that's all you're doing. So that is sort of the divide. If you want to do that, you can still do that. But on the flip side, if you're going to be doing comprehensive financial planning and getting to know your client, it should be done in a fiduciary capacity.
Edward Jurtson is an ISU alum and past president and chair of the National Board of Directors of the Financial Planning Association. He spoke last week at ISU. This is WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories from Alora Kennedy, Judy Valente, and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker.